Good morning, everybody. I guess good morning to you too, Lou.
Good morning. Yes. How are we doing in our isolation here?
Yeah, isolation. That's what I was going to say. I guess everybody's in lockdown mode. Everybody's at home all over the world. And what we're going to do today basically talks a little bit about that. And I'd like to maybe start off by explaining how we get there. So it's going to be more than 20 minutes or half hour, which I usually keep our talks down to, Lou.
Right.
This might be longer because I think it's going to be very revealing, I hope. So before we start, let's use the example. Two examples I want to give you, folks. One is that we each think of ourselves as an entity. You say, I am so powerful, I am so good, I am so knowledgeable, I'm so good at my craft, whatever it is I do, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And really, we don't give enough credence, enough credit to where this is coming from within us. And that's very important because there is a huge, big cosmic intelligence, a cosmic power that enables us to do what we're doing. And that's what this is all about. This takes a lot of effort to understand because it's hard to understand. We always think that we do it. Even as scientists, as physicians, a lot of things that I will be saying now, you may say, well, I did it. My intelligence did it. But if it weren't for this cosmic intelligence, you wouldn't be able to do it. So let me give you an example. And this whole coronavirus thing, COVID-19,
mm-hmm.
Is probably very a way for us to understand what I'm talking about. So just as an example, think to yourself that you're talking to one little cell. Our body is trillions and trillions of cells. And think to yourself that you're talking to one cell in your brain, right? A brain cell.
Right.
And you're saying, what exactly do you do? And the brain cells, oh, I'm the cell of that I, because of me, this happens and that happens, and I change this enzyme and I do that enzyme. So who do you work for? So I work for myself. What are you talking about? That cell may not even recognize that he's a brain cell, that he works for the brain. The kidney cell that works for the kidney may not realize that he's working for the kidney, but he does a great job because the kidney does a great job. The brain does a good job. The heart does a good job. Each one of these organs in and of themselves are very necessary for us as a human being to function. Okay, so far?
Yes.
So think to yourself that that cell in the brain doesn't realize that he's just a small little cog in the wheel for this brain to function. The brain is just one part of the total organism. And the cell doesn't realize that it's basically working at the dictate of the entire human being.
Right.
Now, tomorrow, if I, as the human being that we're talking about, drops dead, that brain cell is going to be dead in a matter of seconds. I mean, assuming, don't take this example to an extreme and say, well, what if you're brain dead and not really dead, that kind of stuff.
But right.
I'm just saying that if I die, all my cells die. So similarly, if I were to get a virus inside me, right? And let's take another example first of food poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
I eat some food, and I've got an exam tomorrow, and I eat the food that is bad for my system. And my system recognizes, before I recognize that what I've eaten is something bad, the system says, get this out of your system now. And I start to throw up, and I get a fever, and I start to heave, and I have to go to the bathroom, and I say, I can't do this. I have studies to do. Let me take something to stop myself from throwing up.
Right.
I got this exam. I got to study. I can't be sick. Body says, hey, I'm going to throw up. Now, the body's not saying that. There's a certain intelligence within our body that is saying that. Where that intelligence comes from is a small piece of the cosmic intelligence that I'm going to be talking about. This is why this example is important to understand, that it's not me. I am actually trying to stop the body from doing this, but the body is throwing it up, so having diarrhea, having vomiting. Ultimately, it gets this thing out. The exam, as far as that cosmic intelligence is concerned, is less important than the functioning and the well-being and the life that is in the body. So the body will throw it up until you say, okay, I'm feeling fine now.
Right.
Too bad I missed my exam, I failed, whatever. But I'm alive and I'm well and I'm feeling healthy again. Now I got to go talk to my professor, see if I can take my exam again. Right. And I do. And that part is that, but the cosmic intelligence kept me alive by throwing up. Take another example very quickly of fever. I have a virus in me and I develop high fevers because the high fevers, high temperatures kill this virus. That's the only thing that kills it. We don't know of a new medication for it. The high temperatures cause me to have seizures, sometimes death, but that's how it is. Sometimes the intelligence goes overboard and kills itself too. That's a whole other story about why this is necessary in the whole functioning of the universe. But I develop high fevers, the virus dies, I get seizures, all kinds of things happen, but then I come back and I say, I'm healthy. Now, I didn't want to throw up, I didn't want to miss the exam, I didn't want to have diarrhea, I didn't want to have vomiting, I didn't want to have these seizures and high temperatures, but the intelligence enough inside me thought that it was necessary to have this so that I can function, so that I can live in the long run.
Right.
That intelligence in me is the same intelligence in a seed. I take a little seed, a mustard seed that is so tiny, it's like the head of a pin, and I put it in the ground, and pretty soon there's a mustard plant there. Now, what gave that mustard seed the intelligence enough to grow up to be a mustard plant? There's something in there that I can't. No lab can make that. No lab knows how to create a seed that gives it life. We don't know what causes the sperm and the ovum inside a man and a woman to come together and give life. We can't do that in a test tube. We can't do that in a thing. But all of us have this intelligence that within ourselves we don't recognize. And I'm not talking about the intelligence that is required to do mathematics or physics or chemistry. I'm talking about intelligence in this fashion. Where does that come from? That intelligence says, I know you are Lou. I know you are Henry. I know you are Tom, whatever. But I don't know what makes you move. I know you're moving, but I don't know what makes you move. I don't know what gives you that temperature. There's something. That now takes us to the second thing which I'm talking about, which is the whole cosmos. What makes this Earth spin at the exact same speed year after year for billions of years? Not one change in 1 mile per hour. What makes this Earth go around the sun? What makes the sun revolve around the center of the galaxy? What makes all of this exactly? What made this whole explosion that took place and the sun and all the planets come around? What made it? And that's what Chapter 4 is going to be talking about. And Chapter 4 basically talks about this cosmic intelligence, this greater consciousness, this Sat Chit Anand. Chit is the existence. That's what this talks about, to say, what is this? But it talks about it in the way that you would expect a lay person to talk about it, just so that you understand that, you know, when you read this, it's made very simply for a person to understand. And you may say, well, it's made in the form of a story. The example that is often given in the scriptures is that of a wave and ocean. And I've used this example many times.
Yes.
So you're the wave. You think, I'm such a big wave. I'm 20 feet high. I could be as good as a tsunami. You're jealous of the next wave. You're friends with another wave. But you still think that you're an individual. But the water that is you, you are the water. The same water exists in the ocean. You come from the ocean. You're the wave because of the ocean. Right. Without an ocean, you wouldn't be a wave. All your qualities are that of the ocean in general, because it's the same water. The ocean is a lot more than just you. You're one wave. The ocean is a zillion waves, millions, trillions of waves all over the world, Earth. And the ocean goes down deep, deeper than the highest mountain that you can imagine. That's the power of the ocean. Now, I as the little wave, and Lou, you as the wave, and so many billions of people on this Earth are all waves. But we are small compared to the big cosmos, the intelligence, the consciousness, what in Sanskrit is called Ishwara. Ishwara, Ish means chief, And Ishwar is the Lord controller. What we have to get out of our head is to think when we say God or the Lord, we sometimes have, we cringe and we say, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in religion. What the Gita is saying is that this is a consciousness. This is a cosmic intelligence. You can call it anything you want. Mm-hmm. You can call it Ishwar. You can call it God. You can call it super consciousness. But it is what makes everything happen. It is what makes the Earth spin, makes the Earth, sun spin around the center of the galaxy, what makes a mustard seed come into a plant. So far, so good with this introduction, Luke?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm fascinated. We're opening a very interesting door right here.
It is. And basically what this chapter 4 will say, Lou, is that when there is unrighteousness, he calls it adharma. Dharma in Sanskrit means many different things. The sweetness of sugar is dharma. The dharma of sugar is sweetness. So the quality within each one of us is dharma, but dharma also means righteousness, morality, ethics, the truth, all kinds of things. And when the world goes towards unrighteousness, this chapter 4 says, I, meaning God, Ishwar, the super consciousness, comes onto this earth to right things, to correct things. Mm-hmm. Now, some may say that every so often when the population of the earth gets to be out of hand, that you have somebody new on my street has 6 cars in their driveway. There's 6 people in the house, 6 cars. Each one of them drives into the city to go to work or college. Each one takes a separate car. Each one pollutes the atmosphere. The ozone layer gets affected, but they have 6 cars. They won't drive together because of the slight inconvenience. They won't take mass transit, although it's very convenient. Everybody has a traffic jam, there's fumes, the atmosphere is being polluted. And Ishwara, the super consciousness, allows this to go on until such a point. It says, that's it, stop, guys, I'm not allowing you. You are all homebound. You're gonna stop, the air gets purer, everything gets, I'm just giving you one example. Yeah. There's many, many other examples of what has changed since the entire world almost is on a lockdown. So many things have changed. Somebody was saying to me the other day, hey, doesn't the sky look bluer than it did before? The governor of California the other day said, he says, hey, without all these cars on in Los Angeles, he says, there's no smog anymore. I can see the sky. The clouds are visible. He says, you can go on the beach. The ocean is so much cleaner. So, and he also said, he says, crime is down. He says, people are being nicer to other people, to their neighbors. People are being more generous. They're helping other people. Now, what has happened is because of this pandemic, people are being nicer to each other. They're taking care. They're not polluting. All of these things have happened as a result. Now, am I saying that this happened because Ishwara stepped in and super consciousness did something? I'm not. I'm just saying that what is beyond my comprehension is what are the actions of this super force that result in these things. I can wonder, I say, hey, is this pandemic something that is caused because we were abusing? There was a video that says, you know, on the ponds of, not the ponds, the canals of Venice, Italy. He says, you actually see now dolphins coming in, or you see swans swimming in areas where there were cruise ships before. Now there's no cruise ships, so there's swans swimming over there. Animals are out, there's, you know, doing things that they would not have otherwise been doing. People have stopped eating, like this whole thing in Wuhan, China. They showed that there was a lot of animals stuffed together in a cage, different animals, different species that were being tortured and then eaten. All of that has stopped. How did that stop? Did I do it? Did the Chinese government do it? Did you do it? No. It happened because of whatever nature did to bring a halt to this. Now, of course, whoever reads the scripture said, hey, it was said that whenever there's unrighteousness, adharma, and adharma, dharma and adharma, have such vast meanings that nobody knows whether this was adharma, what I described so far, and whether this that happened is as a result of what was predicted, that whenever it gets to an extreme, something happens to change it. So that's the introduction, folks.
It's Lou, funny, what you're doing is you're describing the Western understanding of the word karma. And the Western understanding of the word karma is you do a lot of bad stuff, it comes back to get you. You know, and
right.
We've learned it's a little bit more nuanced than that. But what you're describing is you do enough bad things or enough bad actions result in bad consequences.
Right. That's a whole other concept.
Yeah.
And we will talk about that. But yes, you're right. There's some amount of karma here. But so you, if I were to kill an animal and I were to eat it, you know, and whatever I do to torture this animal in the process because it gives me fun, I'm going to get punished in those specific ways myself. But I'm talking about, in addition to that, something different.
Yep.
That as a result, everything has changed. Now, people are in lockdown that didn't need to be in lockdown. But as a result, the whole dharma is being restored. The cars are not on the road. These people who needed their six cars to be driven are calling around to say, hey, I can't park on the street. I have no parking. Would somebody lend me some parking spots in their driveway? So that is getting straightened out. So you're right. Karma is something that also is a very important concept in these scriptures. So with that, let's go to chapter 4. To refresh our minds, chapter 1 was where Krishna is the charioteer for Arjuna. Arjuna has spent his whole life, generations of his predecessors, his generations before him, were all warriors. He's been brought up as a warrior from childhood on. He says, you are a warrior. That's your religion. That's what you have to do. You have to fight for the truth. You have to fight for morality. And you don't have to go and fight. By the way, India has never, in all its history, ever fought another country for its own gain. It's probably the only country that has never invaded another country. It's fought a lot of wars, but always to defend itself, never once as an aggression. So the warriors like Arjuna are there to defend, but to fight the war in defense. And he didn't shirk from wars. He'd fought many before. And in that particular instance, the stress and strain caused him to buckle, bend, throw his bow on the ground and say, I can't fight this war. And what that indicates in terms of an analogy in the Gita is that you and I, as ordinary people, no matter how accomplished you are, no matter how much you've studied, how accomplished you've become in what you're doing, at some point something or the other could stress you out. And as a result, you just throw your pen down and you say, I can't do this anymore. I'm just too stressed. And that was what chapter one was. Chapter two is where Krishna, who is a self-realized person, somebody was born and like us as a human being, but then became self-realized and then became the super consciousness, became Ishwar, became God, Bhagwan. And Krishna then blasts him with the highest philosophy in chapter two. Chapter 3 is we talk about karma. We spent the whole of these last few episodes talking about karma as an action. And bottom line, we learned that actions is of two kind. One is that you have to do your swadharma. You have to do what comes automatically, naturally to you. Don't do something that you think somebody else is doing, but you do what you like to do. And it's better to do that. Better to die than to do something that you don't want to do is what we were taught. But it also taught us that that service should be with sacrifice. Sacrifice of what? Not sacrifice like killing an animal. And sacrifice of your ego. You don't want to say, I did this. I am the greatest. That sacrifice, service with sacrifice. And dedication to a higher cause, a higher being, to Ishwar. So those two things, service and dedication. is what we learned in chapter 3. And here's the key that we learned also, that we all have desires, that those desires we learned were calm and crowed, that produce, when you have a desire, you have, when your desire is not met, you have anger, you have desires for this, you have likes, you have dislikes, and you have to control those. And that prevents you, because your mind is in such a turmoil with these desires that you don't have peace. In order to become successful, both spiritually, but also materially, if you want to be rich, you want to be powerful, like a king, like a raja, you have to be more spiritually minded. So these rajas would become very rich, but they also pursued the spiritual path. In the past, I'm talking about, they did penance, they studied the Vedas, they studied the Gita, and in spite of being powerful kings, they became sages, and they were known as Raja Rishis. Rishi means a sage. Raja Rishi means he is a king and a sage. Hmm. And most of these kings were not only rishis themselves, sages, they lived their life in that way, even though they were surrounded by opulence, gold, silver, diamonds. India was the richest country for probably 80% of all of history until just the past few hundred years. They were very wealthy with gold and silver and everything else. But in spite of that, they were generous to their populations. They gave away a lot of spiritual teaching, and they insisted. And that was why India was called Bharat. Bharat means reveling in light. Bharat is the real name for India. Bharat is reveling in light. Light, not sunlight, that too, but it means spirituality. Mm-hmm. So these Rajarishis, the kings, studied these scriptures and passed them on to their thing. And they were extremely productive. So why were they productive? Here's the lineage. You have desires. As you start controlling your desires, because you're doing service and you're doing service for that, to a higher, dedicated to a higher cause, it results in as the lessening of your desires. Therefore, you become more peaceful. When you become more peaceful, what happens? Your mind can focus better. It's not scattered all over the place. So you become more productive. When you become more productive, what happens? You become more successful. When you become successful, you become materially more wealthy and spiritually more successful in what you're spiritually. You get the spiritual benefit as well as the material benefit. And because you're doing this with your desires focused towards a higher cause, your desires drop off. And that brings us to chapter 4. So, fourth chapter, it starts off with Swadharma, which is your own, what your nature is. You do what your nature is. So if your nature is to be strong, to be physical, you should be a warrior. If you are strong and more physically minded, to sit with a book is not your cup of tea, maybe. Yep. But if you're more intellectual and you want to sit with a book, then to be a warrior is not your cup of tea. So you've got to decide what is your Swadharma. And whatever it is that you do, let's say you're a warrior, you're fighting for the right causes. You say, if there's no injustice, I'm not going to fight. When there's injustice, I will fight to render justice back again to the country. Then you are a warrior. So in knowledge, what we talked about is to gain knowledge in the third chapter, just very quickly. Four methods by which one gains knowledge is, one is pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means direct perception. If you see something, you see that, you see how somebody's making something, you're watching him, you're learning. So right. By direct perception, you're learning something. That's the first. Second is by inference, also known as anuman. Anuman is inference. So you see smoke in the distance. You say, oh, I see smoke, there must be fire over there. So that's by inference. Third is upamana. Upamana means comparison. So you say, it's as hot as fire. So you know what fire is like. So yes. By comparison, somebody says, oh, it's very hot. How hot is it? It's as hot as fire. How brave is he? He's as brave as a tiger. Okay, you know how tigers are. He's as cunning as a fox or, you know, as a snake. So by comparison, which is upamana, you know, you gain knowledge. And the last is by agama. Agama means tradition. You learn, you gain by tradition. Somebody else, a rishi, taught it. It's passed down by the traditions, by the Gita, by the Vedas, and you learn by that. And so that's how you gain knowledge. In chapter 3, Arjuna asks Krishna a question. He says, if the ultimate goal is to become self-realized, Krishna, then why are you telling me, even though I'm a Kshatriya, even though I'm a warrior, you're telling me to fight this war, but you're telling me the ultimate goal of every one of us is to become self-realized, to become one with God, to become one with ourselves. Then why are you telling me to fight this? I might as well just retire, throw my bow down and my sword and take my stuff and go into the forest and go and start meditating. And Krishna says, nah, you can't do that. The only way to get to the higher self is by doing service, and by doing service and dedicating it to a higher cause. That's the only way you're going to do it. He says, your cause right now is to fight because you're a warrior. You've sworn this duty to uphold this injustice that's being done to the population. You have to fight it. So many of us see presidents and prime ministers of countries who are very crooked, very bad for the country, and we have to fight it. We have to do what we can to fight it. But we're not warriors as Arjuna was.
Right.
And he says to Arjuna, you have to do this. So he says, do your swadharma and do it with a dedication to the Lord, to Ishwara. So these next few verses from verse 1 to 10 are teaching us what the Lord is. It's teaching us a few things. One is, many people say, I don't know what the Lord is. You know, the Lord, God, you mean, you know, somebody up there with a beard and a man who's sitting there up on a throne up in heaven. This is, these next few verses from verse 1 to 10, basically to teach us what is God. And we've done this in chapter 3 also, but it goes over again, just in case anybody has forgotten. And it also teaches us about reincarnation, because so far, I don't think we've talked about reincarnation. Have we, Lou? Do you remember?
Not in any kind of depth, no.
Yeah. So in this chapter, in the first few verses, he's explaining to Arjuna, because you may see as I talk about these verses, what is this all about? Why is he saying this? It's in essence a way of telling a story that is indicating to us that there is such a thing as reincarnation. And we can talk for days and about reincarnation. This is a fascinating subject for me. So he's going to talk about reincarnation. He's going to talk about why he is Ishwara, among other things, and how he comes back to earth every time there is any kind of adharma on this earth. We often think, I think in other religions too, they talk about this, right, Lou? About messiahs coming?
Yes.
When there's, you know, bad things happening?
Yes. Yeah, we're right. Always looking for the return of Christ, and yeah.
Yeah. So we often misunderstand when it says, I as the super consciousness, I as Ishwara, will come to correct on earth this adharma that is going on. We misunderstand, we always think of it as a person coming to earth, a man or a woman like Jesus or Buddha.
Right.
And the scriptures say it can come in any form. It can come in the form of an earthquake for reasons that we don't understand. We may say, oh, is this what? But it certainly caused a certain good thing to happen that we didn't realize would happen as a result of this. Mm-hmm. An earthquake, a hurricane, a storm, a flood.
A flood.
Global warming.
A flood, yes, in Christianity. Yeah.
Global warming or pandemic. You know, we always have to keep our minds open to say, what is the purpose? Nature never does anything without a purpose. And what is the purpose of this happening? So we have to understand. Now, in chapter 4, verse 1, Bhagwan, which is God, Ishwara, Krishna, after being self-realized, says, I declared this imperishable yoga to Vivaswan. Vivaswan taught it to Manu. Manu taught it to Ikshvaku. So you scratch your head, say, first of all, who is Vivaswan?
Yep.
Vivaswan is the sun up in the sky. Vivaswan taught it to Manu. Manu is the first man. That's where the word man comes from. Sanskrit is Manu. Manu was the first man, according to the scriptures here. And Manu taught it to Ikshvaku. Ikshvaku was supposed to be the first king of the solar dynasty. So in India at that time, the first dynasty was that of the sun. They were known as the sun worshippers. Mm-hmm. Their symbol, their flags, always had a sun in the middle or a lion. When they moved from India to Egypt, they colonized Egypt. Before that, it was like a desert. And when the Indians first moved over there, they carried the flag of the sun. So they were the solar dynasty and the lions. And there's a lot of books written about this to say, people scratch their head and say, what, Indians went into Egypt?
Yeah.
And there's reasons that we can prove it, because there's things in there in the Egyptian depictions that don't belong. So and belong in India. And you say, oh, that makes sense. I mean, there are things like elephants in Egyptian mythology, or the cobras, which are very common to India, but not common to Egypt.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know this history, so this is all interesting.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast that if in a different lifetime I'll have to do. but yeah, so those were the solar dynasty people. Then came the lunar dynasty, and Krishna was from the lunar dynasty. And that's when those people came. They became the Buddhists, by the way. And there was always clashes between Hindus and Buddhists. And there were clashes between the solar dynasty and the lunar dynasty. The solar dynasty in Sanskrit, for those of you from India, is known as the Suryavanshis, and the lunar dynasty is known as the Chandravanshis. And even today, there's this enmity between the Suryavanshis and the Chandravanshis, the solar dynasty and the lunar. I mean, if you look at many of the Middle Eastern countries, they have on their flag a moon, a sliver of a moon or stars, like right. Pakistan or the Middle East, the Muslim countries. They fight a lot with the solar dynasty. So that goes on without them knowing it for generations. It's almost as if it's inborn in them. But anyway, Ikshvaku was the first king of the solar dynasty. Ram was from the solar dynasty. Krishna was from the lunar dynasty. In the scriptures, there's also the fire dynasty. That's where the Parsis, the Persians, came from, the fire worshippers. And there's also a Brahman dynasty in the Upanishads.
Yep.
So we often say, well, what does all this mean? Vivaswan and Manu and Manu's wife, Shatarupaha, and Manu gave it to Ikshvaku. What is all this? The Vivaswan, the sun that he's talking about, is the one who resides in all of us as intelligence, as awareness. What I was talking about, that intelligence that's inside a mustard seed,
right,
or in the sperm or ovum, that intelligence that makes us throw up when we have food poisoning, when we don't want to, that intelligence that makes us have high fevers and seizures and stuff like that, that is what is the Vivaswan within us. That is the sun. Now, who is Ikshvaku? Manu gave it to Ikshvaku. So all of this, you say, this is bizarre, but it's not. Ikshvaku is also the name of the first king of the solar dynasty. Iksha means eyes. Iksh means eyes. Vach means speech, right? So eyes, Ikshvaku means really eyes and speech. Mm-hmm. So eyes are the organs, symbolize the organs of perception. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin, organs of perception. And speech represents the organs of action. Remember we said there's five organs of action. The speech, the voice box, hands, legs, these are all with which we act.
Yes.
So he's saying that I taught this to the sun, which is to you, your common intelligence. I, as Ishwara, gave this intelligence to you. It came from there to you, to mankind, Manu.
Right.
From there it came to your organs of perception and your organs of action. Meaning, I taught it to you. You have it inside you, is what Krishna is saying. So verse 2, it says, thus handed down in succession, the king sages, the Raja Rishis, knew this. This yoga, by long lapse of time, since I first taught it, has been lost here. Now, when the Gita was written, it was 3,101 years BCE, before the Common Era. 3,100 years before Christ, or before the Common Era, which is 5,000 years ago, he's saying it's been lost. And now we've gone 5,000 years since that time. So you can imagine how far back we are from what he was saying was the great era. Krishna right. says it's been lost here, so I'm here to teach it to you again. He says it was handed down in tradition, which is parampara. Parampara is a Sanskrit word for tradition. He says, I learned it from my guru. My guru is teaching it to you, and so on. So a self-realized person who is like Krishna says, I am God. I didn't learn it from anybody. I had it from me, but I taught it to others who taught it to you. Parampara, para in Sanskrit means higher. Upara means lower. Parampara means going from higher to lower, from teacher to teacher to teacher. So the main teacher teaches somebody who's a college professor, who teaches somebody who's a high school teacher, who teaches a student in high school and says, now you teach the people in kindergarten, that kind of stuff.
Right.
So the cosmic intelligence that we were talking about before goes to the individual intelligence, which goes to our minds, which goes to our sense organs, which are perceptual organs, and then to the organs of action. But this has been lost 5,000 years ago. So verse 3, it says, that same ancient yoga has today been imparted to you by me, for you are very devoted to me and my friend. And this indeed is the supreme secret. So people have sometimes asked, well, why did Krishna only give it to Arjuna? I mean, Arjuna was a kshatriya. He was a warrior. He was on the battlefield. Why didn't Krishna choose a nice, intelligent Brahmin who was focused on studies and he was looking towards being self-realized? Why did he teach it to a guy on the battlefield instead of teaching these valuable lessons? And what he's saying here is, I'm intending this because it's been lost in the world, 3,100 years BCE. The world has become an adharmic place, unrighteous. That's why you're having to fight this battle. If I teach it to a Brahmin who's going to take it and say, wow, I learned the secret, I'm going to go up to the Himalayas and meditate because I want to become self-realized, the population doesn't benefit.
Right.
But if I teach it to a warrior who is not just sattvic but also rajasic, he takes it upon himself, I hope, to teach other people. Because right. that's what I learned from Gautam Jain. That's what we've all learned, is that as you start to learn this, the important thing is to try and disseminate it to others as much as you can. Service with a sacrifice. Sacrifice of your ego, service for the sake of the population. That's what you have to do. So, pure knowledge, uncontaminated, passing it to others, as in a rajasic way. So, interesting thing over here is that from chapter 2, verse 11, to this third verse that we just did is 108 verses. 108, exactly. Don't realize it, but everything in India, a lot of things, are 108. 108 is a very key number. Isn't it 108 beads on a...
108 beads on a rosary. Yes.
In a rosary.
Yep.
108 is a very, and that's a whole other chapter that we have to talk about someday too. Why is 108, why is number 9 an important number in Hindu scriptures?
I'll give you another one, by the way. There's 108 right. stitches on a baseball.
Is that right?
Yeah. I did a whole article on 108 years ago, and I'm trying to remember what I wrote.
Are you fine? You still have it?
I've got to dig it out. I'm talking 20, 30 years ago I wrote this piece on 108.
It would be very fascinating yeah. for me to read that article. And I can tell you whatever I know about 108. But anyway, from chapter 2, verse 11, to chapter 4, verse 3 is 108 verses. And he finishes exactly what he was saying. And then right up to verse 10 of chapter 4, is the whole concept of sacrifice about God and so on. So now verse 4, a new topic starts. Arjuna now asks Krishna, he says, Lord, later was your birth, earlier the birth of Vivaswan, meaning the son was born before you. You're just born now with me. You're about as old as me. You're my cousin. Krishna, what are you talking about that you taught it to the sun? The sun has been here for a billion years.
Right.
How then am I to understand that you taught this in the beginning? Is what he said, a logical question. He says, you're my age. What are you talking about? And what Krishna says is, in verse 5, he says, Krishna starts to reveal his true self, who he is, right? This is where we have to say, well, what is Ishvara? And this is basically for us to understand that there's a higher force than us. Verse 5, the blessed Lord or Bhagwan, Ishvara, says, many births of mine and yours have passed by. I know them all, but you know not. Mm. So this brings up the whole concept of reincarnation. What he's saying is, I, as a self-realized being, represent the force that has always been there. Before the Big Bang, before the sun came about, I was there. I mean, I'm the creator of everything. I'm not a man like you, but I'm the force that caused this. I'm the super consciousness that we were talking about before. I'm the one that's present in you. I'm the one that made the sun and the galaxies and this whole universe. I was there right from the beginning. And I have then come in many forms of since that time. And I know them all because I am them. But you know not because you were just born. Now, that brings up the whole concept of reincarnation, which is what, if this were a guru sitting in the Himalayas teaching, you know, it would lead him to that discussion, but I'm not going to go there for now. But it is an opportunity to learn who is Ishvara, who is God. This says, Bhagawan Uvacha, means Bhagawan spoke, Ishvara spoke, the Lord spoke. He's not saying Krishna spoke.
Right.
Because we're discounting the person Krishna. We're now talking about Bhagawan, Ishvara, who's speaking. He says, this is not my first birth. I've taken many births before this. You too have had many births. The only difference is that I know them, these births, but you do not know them. All of us have taken many births. You, Lou, I, we've taken thousands, millions of births. But because of the impurities of our mind, because we keep fixating on our body, our mind, me, I, my desires, we identify with our body, our mind, our intellect, and we forget that who we are as a self. And when we come to that is when we become one with the Lord, and we stop reincarnation. And that's basically to this chapter 4, the first 10 verses, are to explain to us who is Ishvara, what is this whole thing about reincarnation. Verse 6, by nature I am unborn, ajata, ajaha, unborn. That supreme self is unborn. No place of birth, no date. We don't know when this whole thing started, right? We don't know when the Big Bang happened, but why did the Big Bang happen? Who was it before that? We don't know. This is not something that we know, but those who became self-realized suddenly become aware of that. And it's imperishable, indestructible, Atman. The whole super consciousness, the whole cosmic thing is indestructible and imperishable. He says, I am the controller of all beings, the Ishvara, from a tiny insect to a human being. In the scriptures, we are called Jiva. Jiva means insect. What you and I would call in Hindi or Sanskrit, we would call it Jiva, means small little insects, fireflies, mosquitoes, they're called Jivas.
Right.
The scriptures call us Jivas because, like the analogy I was giving about the small little cell in the brain or the wave,
right,
in the whole comparison of everything, we are a little Jiva. So the cosmic body controls the whole world, the stars, the universe, everything. The cosmic mind is the intelligence of the cosmos. What creates the earth to spin around? What creates the sun to go around the center of the galaxy? What causes everything? And we gave this example of the waves in the ocean. Already. The water in the wave is the Atman. The ocean, the water in the ocean is the Atman.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the mountains, beauty, flowers, the sunrise, we say we are looking at God. We are looking at Ishvara because that's his creation.
Right.
The trick is to start getting away from thinking of God as a man, as a looking to, as a person,
right,
to get away from that and to think of it as pure consciousness, pure energy, because it's hard to comprehend that. We cannot think of it in that sense. There's a force there, an intelligence, a consciousness that's making us do all of this. Chapter 4, verse 7, it says, O Bharata, whenever there is a decline of dharma, righteousness, and a rise of adharma, unrighteousness, then I manifest myself. Bharata means reveling in light. India has, its name is Bharat. India is more of a British name for it than it was before Bharat. India means it's reveling in divine light, spiritual a country. And dharma means godliness, righteousness, morality. Adharma means crime, immorality, vices, and blasphemy. Verse 8, for the protection of the virtuous, for the destruction of the wicked, and for the establishment of dharma, righteousness, I am born from age to age. Now, the scriptures say that, and people often misunderstand to say God is up there saying, okay, the wicked have come, now I'm going to manifest myself, get out of bed, stretch, and you'll get into a new avatar and come and start to fight this.
Yeah.
That's not how it happens. Basically, think to yourself that a country like ours in the United States here now starts to become very prosperous. You start to say, I can afford six cars. I'm going back again and again to that example. But I can afford six cars. I can afford to drive. I can afford this. I can, you know, sacrifice lots of animals for my pleasure. You just to get to be more and more unrighteous. You don't realize it.
Yep.
But you're doing things that are not right. And as this happens, the whole world starts to do all of that. You start to drift towards unrighteousness. And as you become unrighteous, although you don't recognize that you're doing this, you start to become more depraved. There's more crime, there's more unrighteousness, there's immorality. And you, at some level, the world starts to crave for a righteous leader. And there's room now for somebody who comes in. And if somebody is righteous, as there always is, there's always good and bad in everything.
Right.
A good person, a moral person, a righteous person, a self-realized person, then becomes extremely needed and popular. And everybody flocks to him because they say, wow, I'm so hungry for this.
Right.
Not because he came as a result of this unrighteousness, but unrighteousness drifts, runs towards a righteous person. Like in India, there's a few very famous righteous self-realized people right now who have the country and probably the whole world by storm now. Many people are flocking to them because they're saying, I had enough of just money, money, money. I want this. So when he says, I come to the earth, I take birth, I take an avatar, he doesn't mean they come. What he means is that as we devolve into this, we ourselves, when we find somebody who is self-realized, we start to push them up because we are so hungry for it. As opposed to in a time where almost everybody is righteous and there's plenty of self-realized people, you don't give to it. There's just dime a dozen at that time, so you don't do that. Verse 9, he who knows thus my divine birth and acts in a true light, having abandoned the body, is not born again. He comes to me with a capital M.
Yeah.
So he says, whoever knows of me being God, Bhagwan, self-realized, and he, a person like ourselves, gives up his attachment to his mind, his body, his intellect, and starts to do the right things, he will become self-realized and come to me, God. Last verse for today. Have I gone over too long, Lou?
No, it's fascinating. Keep going.
Verse 10 says, freed from desire, freed from fear and anger, absorbed in me with a capital M, taking refuge in me with a capital M, purified by the fire of knowledge, many have attained my being. So he says, you give up your desires, you give up your likes, your dislikes, you do the right thing, you follow the righteous path, and you will become one with me. You will become self-realized, just like Buddha, just like Christ, just like Krishna. You will become as many have done before you. So, Lou, that's the end of the 10th verse in chapter 4.
I
hope this was not too long.
Can I attempt a takeaway?
Please.
Yeah, live more like you are the ocean than you are the wave.
That's right. Recognize that you as the wave are nothing but the ocean.
Right.
Give up this ahankar. Give up this egotistical way of thinking about yourself and think you're just a small drop. Not even a drop. You're just a jiva. You're just a small little insect in this whole thing. Do whatever you can with a dedication to the higher.
But disconnect less and connect more with the bigger consciousness, with the ocean, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah. Do help others. Help others. Sacrifice for others. Give up your own ego. Recognize that when nature comes about with its fury or its power, you recognize how small and insignificant we are. And so that nature is just one small little faction of this superpower that controls the whole universe.
Fascinating.
So I hope you found that interesting.
I did.
Friends.
Fascinating introduction to chapter four. Yeah.
And I hope, you know, you go to Facebook and go to Gita, Memoirs of a Psychiatrist. And I would love to hear your comments and put them down, please. You're sitting at home. I'm understanding that most of you are sitting at home. You have the time. Please put down a few comments, put down questions. I'd love to interact with you. And thank you for listening.